With Tutankhamun and the Golden Age of the Pharaohs, the artifacts from the tomb of King Tut will return to the Deyoung for the first time in 30 years. We sat down with the designer of the exhibition, Mark Locke, to learn more about how this unique show took shape. From the experience of opening the doors of Tut's tomb to opening day at the museum, Locke shares his adventures from the journey of creating Tut.
What was the experience like entering into Tut's tomb in Egypt? What was the atmosphere, and how did it shape your design of the exhibition?
That first visit to Egypt for me was also the visit to Tut's tomb. I think heightened certainly the responsibility you feel with this exhibition. The lock on the gate, you know, was removed, and the gate swung back, and walking down that long corridor. First of all, we all were very much put in the shoes of Howard Carter and his discovery, because it was the same sort of feeling, I'm sure, although that was a different time to discover this most intact tomb of to this day of all time. But I think guests, when they're queued up, getting ready to walk into the exhibition, they have that sense of discovery, that sense of anticipation. And when you hear them say this is a once-in-a-lifetime, the responsibility of what we're all doing, you know, all of us together, partnership with the Deyoung and all of my team, you feel that, the heaviness of that, in a wonderful way, you know. But that visit, and then walking into the tomb and seeing the four chambers, and at the time the mummy was still in the one sarcophagus that remains in the tomb, the only object that is still there. It has since been moved to, it's still in the tomb, but just in a climate-controlled case in the antechamber, away from the burial chamber. But that feeling, the energy of that, the sense of history that I felt as you walked down this corridor.
Why do you think these objects still speak to people as much as they do, and why is the story still meaningful?
The exhibition, the objects, the boy king, has been elevated to a level that really is something we've never seen before. You can say King Tut and people somehow get it. And I think it's three reasons, I guess. The most intact tomb ever discovered. We have this fascination already with ancient Egypt. And when we think of the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, this is the one that had the stuff still inside, you know, and it teaches the academics about ancient Egypt, but it also fascinates us. You know, everywhere the glint of gold, as Howard Carter first said. You've got that. Then you've got, in this case, as the exhibition returns to the United States for the first time in many years and back here to San Francisco, there's been this kind of pop culture energy about it. If you remember back in the 70s when Steve Martin did his King Tut on Saturday Night Live, you know, and everywhere you've looked, as you've got some amazing photographs here of when the exhibition was here in 79, it grew bigger than the exhibition itself. And then I think, one thing that I've been fascinated and gratified to see because of the exhibition, not anything that we've done, but you've got all ages that come to this exhibit. You've got the very young with their parents and with their grandparents together, and that speaks to this kind of once-in-a-lifetime, let's do this all together. But because he was a king at 9 years old, children connect in a way that they usually don't. And even King Tut is fun to say, you know? So there's this different level the exhibition appeals to folks. You know, it appeals in many levels, I guess. The objects are beautiful, the sense of history, what they teach us, the most intact tomb, but there's also this feeling that this is an event. It's history also, as the exhibition comes to San Francisco. I've got to be there. I've got to be part of it. And then when you've got little ones walking out, talking about King Tut, when he died, he had an impacted wisdom tooth, and he had a broken leg, and there's a personal side of it.
What were your criteria for choosing the objects for the exhibition? Obviously, there's kind of an embarrassment of riches. Was there a particular story that you wanted to tell?
Dr. Hawass, Zahi Hawass, if you don't know who he is, you will soon, because he's about as dynamic a personality, first of all, as you'd ever want to meet. He also is the director of the Supreme Council of Antiquities, and if that doesn't sound impressive enough, what he actually does is impressive. He's the guy who really determines where these exhibitions go around the world, and in part oversees the selection of the objects. Besides that, he's today's Indiana Jones. You know, he's an archaeologist who has made some fantastic discoveries. But he's the one with people working underneath him selected these objects. David Silverman, who I mentioned earlier, who curated the exhibition in part in the 70s, we were fortunate enough to get him again. And of course, I always joke with him and flip through the pages of the catalog in the 70s and point out, you know, his bell bottoms and his platform shoes and his hair and mustache, you know. Those things have all changed, but David is being our resident expert and writer of the exhibition. He certainly drives the storyline, but beyond drives it. He writes that storyline. And then it is either vetted or adjusted, sometimes when we come to institutions like yours, by, in this case, Renee, who's right here at the DeYoung. But anything that I do, either theatrically or reveals or placement of objects, it has to pass that test first from David, because, you know, academically, storyline-wise, we have to be accurate.
What's your favorite object in the exhibition?
One of my favorite times always is in the morning when the lights are coming up on the exhibit and you get to walk through with no one in the exhibition. All of a sudden, the objects become very personal. That said, there are two that come to mind right now that I think I call them favorites, enjoy them because I think the guests do for certain reasons. The dressing mannequin, the wooden bust that was most likely used to either for jewelry for Tut to be stored in the evening, or maybe some garments hung over the shoulders. It's the most personal representation of Tut. In fact, because of that, I've used it as the first object. We have 130 objects in the show. 50 of them are from Tutankhamun's tomb. The first 80 kind of give you the history of the 18th dynasty, and I think lead you very well into understanding what was going on at the time, understanding the life and times of Tut before you see the objects from the tomb. That is the second half of the exhibition. But as you turn the corner in a gallery with a single object is this dressing mannequin. And as you walk in, I think it's undeniable that those eyes are looking right at you. They're really looking through you. I mean, you feel a human being there. For the same reason, this human connection, there's a little game board that is no bigger than, half the top of your hand, I guess, that has a wonderful little drawer that pulls out. It's, 2 inches by 5 inches, maybe, by 2 inches tall. And there are little game pieces inside of that drawer. And this was a game that, and I understand it's maybe the precursor to Parcheesi, of all things, as the evolution of games have happened, I guess. But you think of that boy that was king sitting cross-legged against the stone wall somewhere, maybe playing this game by himself. You flip it over, there's another game on the other side. So the personal objects are the ones that I find interesting. Of course, we have the wonderful gold objects and the opulent pieces that remind you of royalty, but the ones that are more personal are the ones that connect with me.
How do you pack and protect these objects?
I think my stress level goes up the most when we are deinstalling and installing, because you're right. It's quite a tense time. The logistics of traveling a show, the objects from one city to the other, it has to be precise. It has to be state-of-the-art in its security, in the cases, the traveling crates that carry the objects. All of that is done at the highest level. But it's also a wonderful time regrettably, I guess, the guests don't see this, but when the exhibit closes, in this case in Dallas, and when the last guest leaves the gallery, the last gallery, the work begins. And that is removing the protective cases and going into the cases and removing the objects. Some are more stable than others. Some are more fragile than others. They all have to have something done called a condition report. And that is pouring over literally thousands of photographs and hundreds of photographs of one object, of how that object looked when it went in the case. It has to be reviewed again that nothing has happened when it's been in that case. You know, was the case bumped? Was there any sort of damage done? Fortunately, as we've traveled it around, none of that damage has happened. But when you're traveling a show, it's tense, you know, that the objects are cared for and they're taken care of. So that condition report is done, and I'm simplifying this process a little bit, but then the object goes in the case or the crate, It travels in secrecy, if you will, high security from one city to the other. And then it arrives and the process begins again.
And of course, we've all heard of the curse of King Tut's tomb. How about it, Mark? Are you a believer?
Well, certainly when you have a problem in the exhibition, you know, whatever that may be, if somehow the lighting has gone out that morning before the exhibit opens, it's easy to blame it on the curse of King Tut. I think the curse started, though, when a rival newspaper was not able to get the first photographs, and they started this rumor of the curse. But I will tell you, as you know, you always have bumps in the road, and you always have moments in doing what we do. There are times when certainly you feel like something's cursed that day, but as far as the curse of King Tut, not a believer.
Out of everything, what is it that you really want the visitor to take away from seeing the exhibition?
Because the expectation is so high, because people define it as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, you want them to walk out the exit of the exhibitions feeling that it met expectations, and that they felt that they just experienced something they'll never experience again. That responsibility mainly relies on the objects, and the objects have not failed yet, you know. So that opportunity to see these pieces, the opportunity to connect with the pieces in a very real way through the storyline that's there, because the objects just don't sit there in cases with a short one or two line explanation. You go on a journey through these different galleries, and when you get to the Tut objects, you are there discovering them, as we talked about, much like Carter did. So I hope people walk out certainly with a better understanding of ancient Egypt and a better understanding of King Tut, but also a connection, I think, a personal one, because these objects speak very loudly about a human being, not just this far-off, untouchable story. It makes it very real when you see that game board, when you see the dog collar that's in one of the early galleries. There's a real personal connection that happens. So I want folks to walk out certainly very excited about their day, feeling as though they've experienced something that they'll never experience again, because that probably is the case as far as the objects traveling ever again outside of Egypt. And walking out with a great deal of enthusiasm and feeling of wanting to talk about this time in history. And because of the objects, that's what I see all the time.
Tutankhamun, the Golden Age of the Pharaohs, will be on view at the De Young from June 27, 2009 through March 28, 2010. For more information or to purchase advance tickets, visit www.deyoungmuseum.org/tut.